The Guardian.
New year, new lockdown, but the vaccines are coming. I'm Heather Stewart, political editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
With most of the country already under extreme measures, it's clear that we need to do more together to bring this new variant under control while our vaccines are rolled out.
After a few days of hinting at more severe restrictions, the Prime Minister announced that England would enter its third national lockdown since last March.
But we now have a new variant of the virus, and it's been both frustrating and alarming to see the speed with which the new variant is spreading.
But of course, the new strain was known about before Christmas, when families outside Tier 4 areas were allowed to mix, albeit only for a day. And we know that the experts on the SAGE committee were already warning on the 22nd of December that even full lockdown, with schools closed, might not be enough to contain the new variant. Yet Boris Johnson delayed the decision to order the public to stay at home until Monday, when it had become crystal clear there was no other option. Anyone else starting to see a pattern here? In his Monday address, Johnson characteristically tried to look for the positives in the grim situation, pointing to the government's hope that it can vaccinate all the most vulnerable groups by the middle of next month. Is that a realistic timetable, or is it another promise that will go unmet? It was children in many parts of England who felt the government's last-minute decision-making style most directly this week. Some ministers, including Michael Gove and Matt Hancock, were convinced days ago of the need to shut schools. Not so the Education Secretary Gavin Williamson, or, crucially, the Prime Minister. On Sunday morning, Boris Johnson confidently proclaimed,
"Schools are safe."
But just 24 hours later,
"The problem is that schools may nonetheless act as vectors for transmission."
Education Secretary Gavin Williamson had already been blamed for last summer's exams chaos and a series of last-minute announcements, not least that secondary schools had to set themselves up as impromptu COVID testing centres with weeks' notice, a plan now rendered completely irrelevant, of course. Can he really survive this latest U-turn? Later on, The Guardian's education correspondent Sally Wheel talks about the current crisis with Estelle Morris, whom you may remember chose to resign as Education Secretary in Tony Blair's government because she didn't feel up to the job. Different times indeed. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, on Monday night, after many people's first day back at work, Boris Johnson told us once again to stay at home. With official figures showing 1 in 50 people in the UK may now be infected with COVID, I'm joined by Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee to discuss how on earth it came to this and what happens next. Hi, Polly. I hesitate to say Happy New Year. I'm not sure how happy it is, but you know, it's a real sort of Groundhog Day feeling, really, isn't it? Watching that statement from Boris Johnson on Monday, here we are again.
Round and round it goes. Exactly the same thing happening over and over again. He's always behind the curve. He's always too late. The people well ahead of him. This time, you even felt that he waited for the opinion polls for the people to tell him overwhelmingly, over 70%, that lockdown was necessary before he took any notice.
Yeah, it's real. It really does feel like a pattern, doesn't it? Back in September when SAGE were calling for a lockdown and, you know, he delayed it and delayed it. I remember talking to people in Downing Street who were saying, well, we can't do it. We can't get ahead of it too much because people have to obey it and people have to think it's a good idea. But I'm not quite sure that's how leadership works, is it?
Well, no, but Downing Street is said to have the most intensive focus group polling operation ever. They do it every day, all over the place. It doesn't seem to do them a lot of good. They don't seem to actually be listening because every time the polls come out, the people are much more cautious than Boris Johnson. They're much less worried about the economy than they are about staying alive, which is quite sensible, really.
How much sympathy do you have, Polly, with these difficult decisions they're having to take? I mean, as you say, they constantly seem behind the curve. You know, when you talk to them, they say, well, you know, we're having to weigh these terribly difficult things. You know, it's people's jobs at stake as well as and their livelihoods as well as their lives. It's not easy. It can't be very easy sitting in there, can it?
No, I think that's true. And I think that's why Keir Starmer is a little cautious, because who would want that job at this time? I mean, I know Boris Johnson wanted it all his life, but it's a bit of a lesson in be careful what you wish for. But nevertheless, the extraordinary thing is his inability to learn from previous mistakes. And we already know that many, many thousands of people died because of his delay right back at the beginning in March, when Sage said if only he'd closed down quicker, that would have saved a lot of lives and perhaps kept some better grip on the whole infection. But he does this over and over again. And each time people can predict, and the people ahead of them saying, I know you're going to close schools. But sure enough, on Sunday, he appears on Andrew Marr and says, no, schools are perfectly safe. And within 24 hours, as you turned, this doesn't create confidence that he knows what he's doing or anybody knows what they're doing.
Yeah, there's a very interesting piece that the pollster James Johnson did in our paper, wasn't there, about this idea that the public almost themselves start to feel like they're ahead of the Prime Minister and almost see him as being, you know, almost a victim, kind of slightly captured by events because they feel they can see things coming.
I think that's true. I think that there has been a wisdom of crowds in all of this, that there's been too much listening to a handful of maverick MPs, the Corona Research Group, who make a lot of noise. They're libertarians. They don't want anybody, you know, any kind of nanny state. They want back the Boris Johnson who used to inveigh against the nanny state all the time. Now they find that he's chief nanny. But there are very few of them. And it turns out in the polling, only about 16% of the public are these annoying people who stride about without masks and some of them even COVID deniers. That's, we're paying much too much attention. I think the media does too much attention to these mavericks.
Because they have a seat in Parliament and are very noisy there. But you can see, I suppose, why Boris Johnson will get a skewed sense of you know, what the national mood was. Although, as you say, he does have all these polls and focus groups out in the field constantly, all the time. He also, another thing that I noticed Marina Hyde mentioned in her column recently, was he talks a lot about how little he likes making these decisions, doesn't he? As you say, he's had to become chief nanny and he does not like it, does he?
He doesn't look happy, but he doesn't seem to get any better at it. I mean, you would think with all of the resources he has, people would teach him how to sound maybe a bit more like Nicola Sturgeon, how to sound authoritative, serious, as if you mean what you say. He always sounds as if he's being dragged backwards to say whatever it is he's saying. He doesn't quite believe it. He doesn't like it. He certainly doesn't understand it. Because when anybody follows up with any question, he never has any detail at his fingertips. By now, it'd be quite easy to have kind of five things written on your fingers as you go into a press conference of basic facts. And I think it is unnerving for most people to think that there is nobody up there. We are not being led. There is no brain at the centre. Listen to the scientists, but the politicians, the cabinet, there's a sense of profound absence.
And you mentioned Nicola Sturgeon there, that there was a sense of a kind of collective effort, wasn't there, before Christmas? So this Christmas relaxation was announced UK-wide and there seemed to be agreement. And even the last minute changes in it just before Christmas, that was ish UK-wide. It's sort of just about held. But that seems to have fallen apart again, doesn't it, that cooperation?
It does, though. I mean, actually, she's only a shade of the difference in terms of policy. She likes to boast about getting there a little bit ahead of him, but not massively. I think it's more a sense that you feel she understands, you feel she's serious. She simply conveys a sense that somebody up there is in charge. You look at Boris Johnson and you think there's nobody in charge. And I think that's alarming.
The Christmas relaxation, this idea of Christmas bubbles, that seems like another example, doesn't it, of failing to follow the science. He has constantly said he's followed the science or been led by the science, but surely that wasn't what the science was telling you.
It was quite plain that Sage and the scientists were all saying the Christmas explosion is a great mistake. We're still only beginning to see the effect of that, and where it's predicted to get worse for the next couple of weeks because of that, because of this ridiculous idea that somehow COVID would also have Christmas and take time off. Well, it didn't, and it hasn't. And again, failure to follow the science, I think, will be always looked back on as quite extraordinary right from the very start of this.
And it seemed like it was politically driven in a sense, didn't it? Because there was this sense that he didn't want to cancel Christmas, was a phrase that you saw a lot used. You know, he felt that would be politically disastrous. But of course, if the consequences of not cancelling Christmas are that we all end up shut in our homes for the first part of the year, that's not great politics either.
Absolutely not. I think he quite wanted to cast Keir Starmer as a kind of roundhead Puritan who would cancel Christmas. So it was a bit of a taunt. It was a bit of waiting to see if Starmer would do that. Well, Starmer suggested a tougher Christmas, but he didn't actually say, you know what, I think everybody should stay at home in their own household for Christmas. He didn't do that. He's been a little bit slow, I think, Starmer, a little bit cowardly on saying what the scientists are saying. And I think Christmas was an example of that.
Yes, he tends to get slightly out ahead of the Prime Minister, but not too far, doesn't he? Well, that's sometimes the feeling.
Yes, indeed. And I think now we know how badly out of step the Prime Minister can get. I think next time this comes up, Starmer should be tougher and stick closer to the science and be willing to separate himself further from mistakes.
Of course, Polly, one success, if you can call it that, that Boris Johnson achieved over the Christmas period since we last did this podcast was the Brexit deal, the dreaded Brexit deal, which finally got done, didn't it, on Christmas Eve. And how much credit do you think Boris Johnson will get from that? How much of a fresh start will it seem? He was hoping to make a fresh start in his sort of global Britain ambitions by going off to India at the end of this month, which of course he's now had to cancel because the virus is running amok. But, you know, is this a sort of fresh start for him?
Well, I think the fresh start is people never wanting to hear about Brexit again. And I think that's what he'll be hoping for. He'll be hoping it simply disappears, an issue on the FT front page and everybody else's business pages, and we don't hear again. I mean, he's been very lucky that, as predicted, the first couple of weeks, perhaps, after Brexit, there are very few trucks going forwards and backwards across the Channel, so that there have been no visual scenes of chaos. But, you know, that's all going to come back shortly, and then we'll see whether these trucks get through all the new restrictions, all the new checks, are there enough vets? And we'll see whether it does become quite chaotic. And it may well still be that during the next few months, there will be a shortage of fresh fruit and vegetables coming from the south of Europe. It may well be that lots of hauliers will simply refuse to do this route because it's too much of a pain. And it may well be that there really is a shortage of goods. Nobody's going to go hungry, but they won't get what they're used to having. And that's the point at which perhaps Brexit will reappear on front pages in ways that Boris Johnson certainly hopes doesn't happen.
He'll also be trying to show how he wants to change Britain's place in the world, won't he, Polly? We've got the G7 chairmanship this year. You know, we've got a new president in the White House. We're hosting the COP26 summit at the end of the year in Glasgow. He'll want to try and show, won't he, that this is a Britain that's still sort of global and interested in the world and outward looking and all that, despite Brexit.
Yes, I think climate is a good one for him. If he can really invest in it, if he can really get something resembling a Green New Deal, set up industries in the places he wants to level up and all of that, if he can get Sunak to release significant, large sums of money for green projects, that's a plus for him. As for the rest of the global Britain, that's all a nonsense. It's not going to appear. There will be no trade deal with America. A trade deal with India will be very thin and would require huge numbers of visas for Indians, for unskilled Indians. I don't think Boris Johnson will dare to agree to that. Priti Patel will certainly put a foot down. So the global stuff is nonsense, but it's just possible, if he's clever, that he could pull off a bit of a climate bounce and a bit of credit for that.
We haven't heard that much from Rishi Sunak, have we, Polly? So he was the great hero of the early phase of last year's lockdown. He was going to put his arms around us and we had the furlough scheme, which was very expensive and quite ambitious. He's been a bit quieter of late, hasn't he? And we hear that he's one of the people who's been arguing for things to reopen or stay open as long as they possibly can.
Well, you could call it, couldn't you, keeping his head down and keeping out of trouble. Let Boris do it. What's in it for him? He suddenly pops up and offers a little bit of money, not nearly enough to keep businesses going. I don't think £9,000 is enough to keep most of these businesses going that are perilously on the edge and some of them going under, and keep saying, look, give us some system over the next few months, not just a little sticking plaster here and there. But nevertheless, he likes to be the one who's coming up with the money. It's behind, as you say, it's behind the scenes. What we hear is that he is the one saying, oh, we're going to have to, you know, pull in our hordes and we're spending much too much money and the debt's much too big. But every country is building up debt enormously. It's not just a British problem. And there's going to have to be a whole lot more of it if we're going to get through this, not just get through the virus, but get through the recession. At least another 2 years of heavy spending to get any kind of lift off for the economy. Is he up for that? We don't know yet. Is he really a George Osborne man? I think he probably is. Will Boris Johnson override him? Let's hope so.
And we should probably end, Polly, by talking about the vaccine. So that's why things are different from last year's lockdown, when it just ended up feeling endless. You know, we now have these vaccines. The government started to roll them out. And Boris Johnson set some very ambitious targets, hasn't he? He hopes by the middle of next month we'll have been able to vaccinate all the most vulnerable groups. Is that a good idea, to set up a stretching target like that?
Well, I think it's a mistake, because every time he's used words like moonshot and all of that, it's all fallen apart. And again, this is a sign of him absolutely not learning from mistake. I think he lives from day to day in a very childlike way, where if he can say something stupendous today, then that's a day well done. Never mind if the knock-on effects of that are disastrous later when he hasn't done what he said he would do. But I think the vaccine is his only political salvation. If it more or less works, if it more or less gets rolled out, even if not exactly to time, everybody will be so thrilled, so delighted, so relieved. The deaths will come right down. It'll still be knocking around as a risk, but nothing like it is now. It'll give, I'm sure, will give him a huge political bounce. And that's his only salvation. And he may well get it. I think it's going to be quite hard for Labour if the vaccine really works.
Yeah, is that your feeling, Polly, that still Boris Johnson could come to be seen as the person who sort of got us out of this, despite the worries about his handling of it through this period?
Yes, I think when nearly everybody's been vaccinated, there will be such a national sigh of relief and joy, and people will be sort of out celebrating, that I think they may forget how long it took to get there, all of the missteps, all of the mistakes. So it would be wrong to kind of write off Johnson. After all, even now, with all these bungles, he's more or less neck and neck with Labour. Labour's a bit ahead. But you might expect him to have plummeted in the polls, and he hasn't. So I would be wary of anyone who thinks he's going away anytime soon.
You know, let's wish Boris Johnson well with his vaccine rollout, even if we might be critical of just about every other aspect of his handling of this. Polly Toynbee, thanks ever so much. Nice to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you too. And I hope that he remembers the teachers in his vaccine programme too.
After the break, Sally Wheel talks to a former education secretary who questions the constant call for cabinet resignations during a crisis. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. Now, the latest national lockdown will be tough for everyone over the next few weeks, but schools returning to remote learning will be an unwelcome must for teachers, pupils and parents around the country. I should know, I've left my own two downstairs at the kitchen table with a pile of worksheets while I record this. Clearly, the decision to shut schools was a difficult one to make, but did the government do enough to make it as easy as possible on schools and students? A lot of people have said they did the exact opposite. And one person is in the firing line for the many missteps that have been taken when it came to dealing with education in England through the pandemic. Gavin Williamson, the minister in charge of exam algorithms, schools reopenings and exam scheduling, has been criticised at every turn. Some commentators have demanded a resignation, but will it come? And should it? Baroness Estelle Morris of Yardley should know more than most. She was the former education secretary in the early 2000s under Tony Blair, but she didn't stay long in the post, deciding herself that she wasn't up for the job. The Guardian's education correspondent Sally Wheel spoke to Baroness Morris on Tuesday about this government's handling of the pandemic.
It's been a while since we talked. I think it was back in March 2019 when we were talking about another crisis facing schools, which was the sort of financial crisis.
Yes.
And you were very concerned then about what was happening. But, I mean, it has been eclipsed, hasn't it,
yes,
by the events of 2020 and now this year. Just first of all, just tell me about your reaction to last night's announcement when Boris Johnson told the nation we were going into lockdown and schools were to close again.
There was a bit of an inevitability about it, really, and it's not the first time that we've been there. So in a way, I ended up being pleased that a decision had been made and at least parents, children and teachers knew where they stood for this morning. So at least it was more certainty for this morning than it had been for yesterday morning. So in a strange way, I'm not sure this is the right word, but there was a sense of relief that at least there was some certainty, and we, or head teachers and teachers and those who work in schools, could get on and work out how to respond to it.
So, yeah, some certainty at last after lots of to-ing and fro-ing. But throughout all this, we've seen so much uncertainty, delayed decisions, things which don't appear to have been thought out very well. I mean, do you think at some points during this whole crisis there could have been better plans in place to avoid the kind of uncertainty that families and schools have had to deal with?
I actually think that's the key thing. And I made my own mistake that I don't like others making when in the answer to my first question. And that is really that it's no good complaining about uncertainty at this time because it's part of the game. We can't have certainty. That's what the pandemic gives us. And I actually think that teachers and schools are really quite good at dealing with change. So I don't think, if I can rephrase that really, it wasn't the lack of certainty that I think has caused the problem. It's the lack of confidence in the way decisions were being taken. And there's just a subtle difference. So if you say to teachers, look, we can't predict what's going to be right, what's going to happen in the future. I'm sorry, but that's the way the world is. It's uncertain. But this is what we're considering. This is when we hope to make a decision, and we'll make you part of that decision. I think they respond well. So shorthand has become from teachers. We lack certainty. I'm not sure that's what they're actually saying. If I may say, I think I hear what they're saying is we lack confidence in the process of decision making that could help us deal with the uncertainty that is inevitable.
I mean, you are one of those rare people who has been an education secretary and a teacher.
Yes,
so you know it from both sides. So I'd be really interested to know, you know, what your feelings are for teachers and head teachers and other school staff, you know, who've been sort of grappling with this for months, but particularly over Christmas, when I know so much work was being done to try and sort of prepare for the new term, suddenly to find out one day back into term that everything was closing down again. What are your feelings and thoughts and, you know, concerns for them?
And if you take into account one day before the end of term, they thought they were setting up for mass testing. So that's how they've spent the Christmas holidays. And then it's changed. I mean, they must be weary. I am in awe of what they've done. And they must be tired, frustrated, fed up, dispirited. They feel that part of their problem is the government. And that's so important. If you're battling a pandemic and you don't know what's going to happen and you're worried about your kids and you're worried about everything else, to feel that the government is ending up making things more difficult for you, I think is almost a burden too much. So when you say to me, how did they feel? I think they must have felt all those things about being wearisome and I've got to start again and can I manage it? But also at the back of the head, you know, don't want to swear, but those so-and-sos, how dare they make it so difficult for us again? And I think the government ministers have been energy sappers during the last year, and that's not their role. That they should have been energy givers. They should have bolstered the energy and the determination, even though things were very difficult. So there must be people in the DfE who understand the rhythm of the school year and the school term. And if you understand that, you don't make announcements the day before the end of term. You understand that that's not the way the rhythm of schools work. And although schools have had to find a new rhythm, there is still that pattern of the term and the holidays and the winding down and the building up. So I think it's a bit of a lengthy answer, Sally, really. But that's been my biggest worry, that on top of everything, teachers must have felt that why are they making life more difficult for us than it need be? And that need not have been the case.
Exactly. I mean, I think one of the most extraordinary moments in this whole crisis has been just before Christmas, when schools in areas of rising infection rates in London were seeking to close their schools because they were seeing infection rates rise. And Gavin Williamson and the Department for Education, they launched legal action against a couple of London boroughs. How damaging do you think that was in the kind of relationship between schools, teachers, head teachers and the government?
It was a sign of something. And I think this goes back almost to the start of the pandemic and is the source of the trouble. For some reason, the education ministers have made education a political divide. In the way, with respect, I don't think there has been about the health service or about our cultural institutions or about anything else. So I sense the way I felt before Christmas was when Gavin Williams decided to send or to make arrangements for that legal letter to be sent. It wasn't about getting the children in for the last day of term. Anyone who knows anything about schools knows that the children were not going to lose out a lot by not being in for the last day of term. It was nothing to do with that. It was part of this. I've got to show the education sector who's boss. Now, it's as though the government put their political credibility on keeping children in schools. Now, what they could have said was, our major priority is getting kids in schools. And we know we share that objective with teachers and parents. It could have been a great unifier, couldn't it? It could have been the thing that, as a nation, we all joined together on. Of course, that's our priority, to keep them in schools. But the language has never been like that. So the language with that letter was, you want to send children home. I want to keep children in schools. I think there was some messy behaviour by the trade unions at the start of the pandemic, which didn't help. But I think that they've almost all, almost without exception, every teacher I've spoke to has worked their socks off to keep the kids in school. Why make a political divide about it? We are on the same side, and there's enough to argue at the moment without making that one of the things that divides us.
One thing I wanted to ask you about was now what happens in schools and the return to remote learning for most children and young people. That's been a big worry throughout the pandemic. Certainly at the beginning, it was clear that, I mean, it was a big panic to get remote education set up and rolled out. And in the months that followed that, we have seen the kind of problems that lots of children have had accessing it, and the divide that has built up between pupils, those who are more advantaged and those who are less advantaged, and the consequences of that. Where do you think we are now with remote learning? What are your biggest worries about it, and what should the government's priorities be?
Wow, this is the big thing, isn't it? Because it was sort of inevitable that at some point children might be asked to learn remotely again. There's been a lot of months to put things in place. And I would be absolutely furious if we're not now in a position where there are sufficient devices to be sent home for every child. Quite honestly, I'm taking that as the minimum, that if this time round there's any shortage of devices, that is inexcusable from a government that's just got to get them into school. But that's the basic, isn't it? That and then the internet connection. I'm sort of just assuming that we can solve the relatively easy stuff, which is connectivity and computers. But I think the really difficult side of this, I think we're concentrating a lot on children having missed out on facts. So they've not learned the content of the syllabus, or they've got behind in their times table or whatever. I think the bigger divide, isn't it, is going to be the children who've lost the habit of learning and have lost their enthusiasm for learning.
So just to move on to another shock in Boris Johnson's announcement last night was that summer exams will be cancelled once again. That's after the government, and particularly Gavin Williamson, have gone to great lengths to come up with some version of exams for this summer, and to say there's sort of no way that exams are going to be cancelled again after the fiasco last year. But here we are again. Exams have been cancelled, and we seem to have very little idea of what's going to replace them. What are your thoughts about that, and what might happen now for these students, and just in general, how the whole question of exams has been handled during the pandemic?
I mean, to be honest, the fact that they would have to cancel exams was more predictable than almost anything else. And and that's not with the benefit of hindsight. I always was unhappy with the new arrangements. And it falls into that pattern, I think, of he took the side of, in fact, if you look through Gavin Williamson's speeches over the last few months, how often do he and his colleagues say exams are the best form of assessment? That's irrelevant. It's not true and it's irrelevant. So he's made it a political dividing line again. It's following the wrong route all the time, setting up the wrong atmosphere and the wrong relationship between the profession and himself.
So the person in charge of education throughout this has been Gavin Williamson, and he has come in for a lot of criticism from lots of different quarters. And there has obviously been a lot of criticism aimed at the government in general over its handling of the pandemic. How fair do you think the criticisms of Williamson have been? I mean, what would your kind of end of year report be on him and how he's handled the pandemic?
I agree with you that I can't think of any Secretary of State who's, you know, has had a pandemic to deal with. So I don't for 1 minute underestimate the challenges. I really don't. I think it's been difficult. And also, he was fairly new to the job at the time, so he had no reputation. He had no strong foundations with the profession on which to stand and build a response to the pandemic. And I think that's been a bit of a problem. I don't know how much he understood them at the start of the session. He'd not made a lot of speeches about schools. He'd not said a lot or indicated a way forward. So I don't think he had the best of start. And I don't think it helps to sort of say whether he should resign or that. But we need him to do well. As long as he's in that job, we need him to do well. And we need him to do better than he's done so far. He has made errors, but anyone would have done. I can excuse the errors. It's the attitude that bothers me. And I think what I want to see from him is a mindset that means that he tries to get the profession and all who want to help on the same side. He's got to construct a common agenda and a common language. But it is difficult to look at the last year and not conclude that the government really could have done better as far as its delivery of education has been during the pandemic.
I mean, there have been calls for his resignation, and not just his resignation. There have been other people have been targeted in the same way. You very famously did resign and were very honest about your reasons for it and just said, basically, I didn't feel I was up to the job, which a lot of your colleagues disagreed with. But that must have been a very, very difficult decision to make. Looking back on it now, how did you arrive at that decision? And was it the best decision at the time? Is resignation always an answer?
No, it's not always an answer. And I'm conscious, really, that I resigned, but there was a consequence for that for those I left behind. You know, it wasn't a helpful thing in terms of smooth transition within the Department for Education. So it isn't always an answer. And I do think that's part of the reason why I wouldn't call for his resignation. I'm not sure how helpful that would be. But what I do know that governments can do, and this is the way I would want to go forward, if the minister's struggling or, you know, and for me, Sally, the key thing is the confidence. If he thinks he's lost the confidence of the profession and the public, that's the point at which you need to act. You can get things wrong and you can make them right again. But I think for me, it's the confidence of those who are meant to be your partners in delivering the system. And I do wonder if a way forward for the government isn't to put more in around him or to bolster him. And I think part of the problem is that when he opens his mouth, I think we've got to the stage where we're already either fearing what he's about to say or wondering when he's about to U-turn, or not trusting it because we don't trust him. And I'm wondering if the government couldn't be a bit creative and get a group of people, and when announcements are made about education, although Gavin Williamson has to take the responsibility, he can say that it's got the support of an advisory group. I suppose my parallel is when the health secretary makes a big announcement about health, he always has alongside him the scientists and the health advisors to give the evidence about why he's made that decision. It doesn't free him from political accountability, but it gives us, the public, the facts as well as the politics. So call it a council, call it the Secretary of State's Council for Education during the pandemic. I don't mind what you call it, but I think the voice giving the leadership at the moment isn't trusted sufficiently to carry the profession with it. And I think there are ways of changing that.
We should say that since recording the interview, it was announced that children who don't have access to laptops have been designated vulnerable and can therefore go to school. But that's all from us this week. It's been a pretty busy week in the world of US politics as well. On Monday, Jonathan Friedman spoke to our Washington Bureau Chief David Smith about the truly scandalous phone call made by President Trump at the weekend to Secretary of State in Georgia, Brad Raffensperger, demanding he overturn the presidential election results in his favour. This played out in the shadow of a hugely important week in Georgia, where polls closed on Tuesday in two Senate runoff seats that could, if they go the Democrats' way, as early results suggest, be hugely influential for Joe Biden's presidency before he even takes office. Jonathan will be back later in the week with Sam Levine in Georgia to update us on the results there. But for now, I want to thank our guests, Sally Wheel, Polly Toynbee, and Baroness Morris of Yardley. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. More than ever, please look after yourselves, and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.